Special Senate Committee on Healthcare Reform. Welcome, everybody. Today is Wednesday, April 18th. We are going to continue having public testimony on 329. But before we get into that, I want to take just a moment and talk about some of the results, if you will, or take it as evidence that we listen. Based on the public testimony, we had... Oh, I hope that's only a cell phone. I thought that was... Oh, well, a guilty party, please stand up. And anyway, I want to indicate that we are very sincerely listening up here, and as such, take a moment and go through a couple of proposals that we'll be working into the Dash 5s. One is a clarification in Section 4, Sub 2. Let me get my bill out. There's been some confusion created about what we're really trying to get at here, and what it is, in just simple language, is that, you know, in addition to, we're going to develop options or alternatives not to exclude current employer-based health care. So there will be a public option available in subsection 11. It's the subcommittees, and we're exploring the ideas. I think we want to flesh this out a little bit more, but we're exploring the ideas of replacing the subcommittees with some of the existing commissions. I think it's pretty easy to see where finance could become the Oregon Health Policy Commission, delivery, OOPRs ideally suited to take up that task. Eligibility, the MAC, Medicaid Advisory Committee, is already doing a lot of eligibility stuff. And benefits, obviously, Oregon Health Services Commission. We do this not only because, you know, of cost issues, but there's already a deep body and reservoir of expertise that's been developed in these areas. So we're looking at that. A couple others. We are definitely going to include a federal policies committee to look at Medicaid, our tax code, and TALA, certainly Medicare, where they present impediments to achieving affordable and effective health care. So you're speaking and we're listening. Do you have any comments you'd like to make?
I think you've covered it well. I just want to make sure everyone understands that we take your testimony extremely seriously. That's why we're on the Dash 5s already. As you all know, there's a private bet going on. My number is 7, so I ask for some cooperation tonight. We want some, but not too many. We want to get to the 7s and win here. But what you give us is really important. We keep careful notes, and we try to integrate that into the process of looking at this. Not everything you give us will be put in the bill, but a great deal of it is, and it helps us refine and look for things we didn't expect. Some things we put in the bill have been interpreted vastly differently than we meant them to be, and we've gone back and corrected that language. So we will see it as a continuing process through the rest of this week, and my hope and intentions are that within a week to week and a half, the bill will be completed. So thank you for your work, and we encourage you to keep the work coming in.
And one other that is causing great confusion, and I'm trying to find it. It's in the eligibility section. We keep using language. It's in on the Dash 4, it's page 14, line 21, sub F, excluding coverage for pre-existing conditions for a period of 1 year. Everyone thinks we're trying to exclude pre-existing conditions. We're not. What we're trying to craft is language that takes into account federal law, whereby when one individual just functionally signifies the intent to be a resident of any given state, they are, by federal definition, a resident of that state. We're trying to find that middle ground where we don't get the woodwork effect going where people are all of a sudden flocking here because of pre-existing conditions. So that section has caused some confusion. We're additionally working on that one. So without further ado, we have some distinguished witnesses. Let me call up first our good friend Christine Chin Ryan. Please enter and sign in, please. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's only painful for the first 20 minutes.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to hand this up before.
Oh, just give them both over here.
While Christine's doing that, we have also some written testimony from the DD Coalition. And is this all part?
No.
And also from TJ Schaefer. So we appreciate that as well.
Okay. Well, Co-Chair Bates, Westland, and committee members.
You got to get real close to that, Christine.
I want to thank you for scheduling this evening hearing, and I appreciate your effort to accommodate all of us who wish to testify. Before I delve into specific concerns, which I would like to bring to your attention in connection with this bill, I would like to commend Senators Bates and Westland on how open the process was and still is in bringing the stakeholders to the table for a much-needed discussion. We have to have effective health care reform. We know the current system is broken. A large number of citizens is today without health care access, and employers are facing the double-digit premium increases. Senate Bill 329 is a practical and achievable proposal that we can get done this session, and it sets the roadmap on how we can achieve effective health care reform next. I want to strongly express my opinion on how essential it is to include small businesses or employers in this process of health care reform. Without the support of small businesses, we will not have health care reform. Small businesses represent over 50% of Oregon economy today. I have four concerns. The first concern is the funding mechanism in Dash Amendment 4 does not include insurances of affordable rates for small businesses. And I think that was on page 6, section 4, and page 9, section 10. The second item is inflation is not included in the cost containment portion, such as putting in an inflation factor tied to the CPI and instead of letting the insurance providers set the rate. The third is the pre-existing conditions coverage exclusion, and I think you addressed that, Senator Westland, which imposes on an unfair burden on the employers and employees and penalizes individuals with health problems, the very issue insurance is designed to remedy. This pre-existing coverage condition is also unconstitutional and is contrary to federal HIPAA law. So then I realize that you've addressed that. The fourth concern I have is small businesses dash employers are not included in the health trust board. I recommend changing management on line 23 to businesses to include small businesses, since businesses may be funding or financing a portion or all of the essential benefits list, as well as if you want to also put a condition on the pre-existing condition to ask businesses to help fund that. I'm not quite sure why businesses were left out of the representation on that on page 7, section 5, lines 16 to 28, the makeup of the board. But I was very disturbed about that, why we were not. Page 7. Section 5, line 23, it says areas of consumer advocacy, management, finance, and labor. As a small business owner and chair of the Oregon Small Business for Responsible Leadership, I want to tell you that I and my organization have paid keen attention to the health care insurance issues affecting and needed by small businesses, as well as Senate Bill 329. And while we express our support for the efforts presented by this bill, we have recommendations, and the recommendations in the back, which I think all of you have seen, that's what you know, a group of small business owners submitted to the Senate Healthcare Access and Affordability Commission. So I don't think I need to repeat it. That's my testimony. Thank you. Any questions?
I've got a couple, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
On the back, Christine, you talk about establishing a state health care coverage pool, and we clearly understand that employer mandate is not supported by the Small Business Council. If I'm reading this correctly, you do support the idea of a health care coverage pool in which all employers would have an option to take part in.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways we're envisioning this is that if you already have insurance for your employees or you're self-insured, that if you don't have one of those two options, you should be in an affordable pool. Is that something that's still acceptable to you?
As a mandate?
We're debating that. I mean, we want to get everybody into the tent, so to speak. And one of the ways of getting them in the tent is if you're not doing insurance yourself as a benefit or you're not self-insured, that can we bring you into the pool, either by a mandate or not by a mandate?
I guess I'm not.
We're not mandating individual companies or employers have a benefit or a health. We're not mandating they have a benefit or that they have to have insurance for their employees. What do we say to them? You have to be a part of a pool. This is the same thing in different words to you? I'm not sure what you said in your third bullet point appears to say it's essential as many as possible, if not all employers participate in the pooling in order to achieve the best cost and buying power of benefits. Do you think this should be something that's attractive enough so that everyone will just join?
Yes.
Okay.
I think with all the points there, I'm sorry.
I'm just trying to make sure I understand what you're saying here.
I think with all these issues here we've had is if, you know, with a low cost, with an employee shared, I think that will entice employers to join, and I think that was part of the feedback we had given you in the past. Most from what we've heard for other small businesses is that they do want to offer health care. It's just too expensive. So basically, we feel a mandate is not going to work without some exceptions. And we think we just wanted to give you our viewpoint on this. But I would like to come back on the trust fund board as to why was it taken out of having businesses represented on the health care trust fund board.
Okay.
That concerns me quite a bit.
Let me get there just a second, if I could ask you this before I lose my train of thought here. The key operative word throughout this and throughout the bill is affordable, and that everything is predicated on offering insurance at an affordable level. Now, you can argue what affordable is, but at least that's in there, meaning it has to be something along the lines you've put in the back of this. If it's not affordable, then they held down costs, then it's not going to work, and we understand that. We're trying to set this plan up.
Right.
That it directly addresses that through many things that you've got in the back of this sheet. But we're not going to be in a position, and I don't think as a legislature we should be in a position to tell a board of experts with subcommittees that are expert in these fields what they should or shouldn't do to achieve that affordability. We could list 20 things. We'd leave off 15 for sure. Okay. Now, on the other issue, one you're going to is what does that board look like, the ultimate board? We do not want providers on that, which we've been roundly criticized for. We wanted those who pay for it and those who receive the benefit to be there, and that goes directly to having the business community on that. We did not, at this point, make a decision that first board, which was a temporary board there for about a year and a half, a design board, to necessarily be too small business, too large business, and the kind of language we've had before. But we did exclude the people who benefit from the system directly, not people receiving the benefit as patients do, nor people who are paying for this, which in all, for the most part, are employers and employees contributing to this. That's the group we want on that board.
I understand that, but why is not why is it not mentioned there, business or slash employers, as the, you know, with the makeup of the board? What does management mean? If I mean, I've understood in the past, I've heard you said you wanted the payers to be made of the board, whether it's consumers and the businesses, but I don't see that in there. And I guess I'm, when Senator Westland came to spoke to the OSBRL steering committee, we actually endorsed it, you know, in the original form and you know, expressed, you know, our ideas or questions on small businesses. Now, if we're not going to be represented on the board and you're asking us to pay for some portion or all of the essential benefit lists eventually when it comes out and so on, if you want us to be involved with the payment of this health care, we should be included in the board.
I may not be able to satisfy you. The language I see here is board members shall have expertise, knowledge, and experience in management, finance, and labor. To me, that's business owners. I don't know who else that would describe. I still don't know who else that would describe. That's what we tried to do.
Here's what we're trying to say. If we put a representative of big business on there and small business, next thing we'd have would be someone from middle-sized business. How come we're not there? You start a list like that, it never ends. Okay. What we're trying to get to, though, is exactly what Senator Bates said, is represented by two groups of people, the payers, and that's small business, and consumers.
Well, I just want you to know that the small business owners that I've spoken to about this, none of us
they're concerned about that.
Interpreted management, finance, and labor, it means business. So I just want you to know that if we all misinterpret that,
maybe
that's why I expressed the concern.
I understand. I guess I'd ask you to look at it just from a little different twist. What you don't see here are physicians, insurance companies, nurses, hospitals. You don't see those in here. And trust me, they wanted to be here. And we've been roundly criticized by them for not having them here. We want this to be a board of what we just described, which is a very big change for looking at the management of healthcare. Okay, and there's many people in this room and outside this room who feel that this board is not appropriate because of the language here. And the people who are trying to get on the board, you're telling us it's not appropriate for them either. So I don't know where we go here and be more explicit in what we're looking for.
Let's see what we can get figured out.
Okay. We'll keep working with you, okay? We are trying to get there.
And we have been working with you, and we want to continue working with you. And, you know, and I think we've also expressed that, you know, many of us do offer health care, and we do want to offer health care. And so that's why we want to be part of the process because, you know, we want it affordable so more businesses can pay for it.
Christine, I really believe the qualifier in this board composition is the language that requires these persons to represent the best interests of Oregon as a whole. And that's not just small business or mid-sized business or big business or retirees or children, but the best interests of Oregon as a whole. And that is the intent.
And I think working with all of you on this issue, I think we understood that. It's just we want to make sure that, you know, we are not excluded. And like I said, we misinterpret what you were trying to say there because, like I say, none of us who have been involved in keeping track of this healthcare reform process for the last year has... We came to the same conclusion.
Mm. So kind of went ouch, huh? Well, Mr. Chair,
wait, you have a follow-up?
Well, I did, but it was I would like to go back to discussion of mandates, but if you have something to follow up here.
Go first.
Okay. The issue of mandates not being supported by Oregon business, would that also include, and this certainly hasn't been identified, the financing mechanism? If you're looking at, you know, a health coverage pool, so to speak, and including all businesses in it, probably would migrate to some kind of a payroll tax. I guess maybe if you could clarify what you would perceive as employer mandates.
Well, total, what would mean my total employer mandate, that employer pays for 100%, or pays for the majority of it. I think it should be shared. The original Senate Bill 329, as far, or, you know, things I've discussed in the past about, you know, maybe minimum splitting the premiums, and then it's up to the employer then to decide whether they want to pay more. I think that's more equitable. I think if you can keep the benefits low, that would you split it between the employer and the employee. We're also concerned that the employee can afford to pay for their share also, if an employer can't foot the bill for the total premium. But if you expect the employee to pay for it 100% and as a mandate, I think there would be a lot of resistance to that, and that's what we've been trying to say for the past year. And that's why we've been working with you, so that your time isn't wasted, you know, by getting that resistance.
Yeah, we don't expect the employer to pay 100%.
If in fact there's an employee payroll tax, it's not going to be all on the employer. And this bill doesn't say there's even going to be one. This is a roadmap to where we're trying to go to for universal health care access and controlling and bringing down costs. It's not going to actually in itself do those things. It'll hopefully leave us there. I want to ask a couple more questions, get your opinion on a couple of things real quickly, though, if I could. First, I appreciate all the work you've done in the last year, and I hope we didn't mislead you or feel you've been misled by our language here. We really are trying to stay with the issue we had before. We can have more conversations privately on this, and I would accept the language from you, too. But you know we're trying to drive this. There's a big question about pre-existing conditions right now, and we've tried to get language that says, without breaking any federal constitutional law, that if you come to the state just for health care and no other reason, because we have a universal system, that we have to exclude you for 6 months or a year. We are having a real struggle with that and probably can't reach that. Here's the question I'm leading to. How would you think the Small Business Council would feel if the statement was that you only have to be here 90 days for any pre-existing condition, and you are into the plan? It's simple and straightforward. It doesn't matter if you've lived somewhere else, come here, what your residence is. There's a 90-day waiting period, and whether you have a pre-existing condition or not, since we have 100% access, at that point you're in.
Well, first, I'm not representing the Governor's Small Business Council.
Okay.
I want to make that very clear.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Secondly, I think if you put things... You approach it as giving the employer the option of maybe picking it up or paying for it or so on. As you know, give the employers options of what they want to do, I think, is one way of doing it. I'm not saying I have all the answers. I can go back and talk to my small businesses and help you with some of these issues that we, you know, if you would like, you know, how to what small businesses, you know, can live with. And remember, we are not going to get 100%, you know, of small businesses behind this, but I think, you know, you can get a majority or a big chunk of it. But I can get back with you on that. Let me consult with my small businesses.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Christine.
Thank you.
Before we proceed, I think most of you probably already know this, the House, where is the committee tonight? The House is still in session. Bill Morissette's out of town. Lori Morris Anderson is required to be in another committee, and Jeff Cruz, well, who knows where Jeffy is? Jeffy is where Jeffy is. So if you're listening, Jeff, come on down. We've got someone that I know lives 100 miles away, and then someone
whose cell phone went off during the proceedings. So would Kelsey Wood and the cell phone lady please come forward? Let's see, if that's Kelsey, this must be a malady of modern-day life. It happens to us all, Lana.
And I even showed her that button that turns the volume down.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm blushing to the roots of my hair, I can tell. For the record, I hate to admit it, but I'm Lana Butterfield, and I apologize for my cell phone going off. I'm here on behalf of the professional insurance agents, and we have some written testimony for you, but I thought the very best thing I could do is bring to you Kelsey Wood from Roseburg. He served on the commission with Dr. Bates during the interim, and he's been a very moderate force within the PIA cadre of agents, and we've really put him forward because of that. So I'll let him give our testimony.
Roseburg, where Senator Cruz's district is.
Yeah.
Chairman Dr. Alan Bates, co-chairman Westland, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kelsey Wood of Gordon Wood Insurance and Financial Services in Roseburg. I'm here representing the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon, Idaho, or the PIA. Some of our members sell health insurance, as do I, and we're here on their behalf. PIA recognizes that health care, of course, the health care system needs to be reformed, and we offer complete assistance to that reform, but are concerned about what this means for our independent agents in the new system. It's not clear under the current Senate Bill 329 that agents' role will be in either the exchange or the secondary market. We want to remind you that Oregon already has a team of over 20,000 resident, licensed, educated, regulated, professional health insurance agents, now called producers, who work with health insurance consumers daily. We provide information, knowledge, and counsel about insurance, helping customers make the choice that's right for them and helping them to understand what it means for their own situation. Not only does the state of Oregon have a well-established distribution force in its health insurance agents, but they're quite accountable as well. Agents are accountable to their insurance companies, their partners by contract, or employment agreement, and relationship. The state's insurance regulatory body also enforces good consumer protection. Agents are also open to criminal law and civil law for alleged errors and omissions, goofs and mistakes. And we're insured for that as well. The current distribution force does come with a cost. However, whether commissioned agent or paid company employee, the residents of this state have access to a personal relationship with someone responsible to deliver a process, allowing for an informed decision. Any enrollment system will have a cost to it. Will any other enrollment system deliver the level of accountability and informed choice? The value this distribution force can deliver can be seen in a role that some of us choose to play with the new enrollment process for Medicare-eligible residents, the Medicare Part C and D, for example. Medicare-eligible residents now have many choices available to them, such as not ever been seen since the federal regulation of Medicare supplements in the 80s. In my rural county, for example, before Medicare changes in 2006, Medicare-eligible residents had a very limited choice. The market was dominated by a few players with little incentive to provide a better or lower cost product. Recent changes in the law have created competition, resulting in a multitude of options. And now pricing, from the traditional cost of $150 per month, go now down to $0 per month, with managed care taking the lead in some of those options. Due to a now competitive market, robust with alternatives, the decision process is more difficult. But being in the industry, educated on planned choices and variables, the agent community is expert in disseminating variables between plans to help our clients choose a plan that meets their best needs. We have relationships with these people, usually including responsibility for their homeowners, their auto, and their business insurance, too. So with an ethical, moral, relational, and legal obligation to provide clients with an informed decision-making process, PIA agents deliver value and choice to the insurance buying public. We would caution the committee in thinking about enrollment in an exchange in simplistic terms that don't take the human nature into account. Yes, information provided electronically, say by a website, is a good thing, but what about the 85-year-old who does not have access to the web or a computer? Who will answer questions from people who are trying to understand the massive changes that will come about from this healthcare reform? We know from trying to contact the Massachusetts system ourselves for more information that their process is overwhelmed in terms of simply even giving us information. Oregon has a team of people ready through its cadre of licensed, regulated insurance agents that can be a helpful army and should be deserved to be considered. Reform does need to proceed cautiously. We would ask that the board establish for the interim also be given the charge of studying the enrollment process, keeping in mind the great potential good that insurance agents can deliver and the value that they can bring in helping to transform the system. I've included in your package an example of a letter from a client describing exactly the difficult process in choosing the right insurance program and the value a professional agent can bring to them. Thanks for your time, consideration, and may we together work to reform the healthcare system in Oregon.
Thank you, Kelsey. As always, your input is not only valued but valuable. We don't see any reduced need for your professional expertise. I hope you don't interpret the bill as doing away with knowledgeable, licensed, caring agents.
Well, Senator Co-Chair Westland, with comments like, well, maybe we can enroll people through hospitals, or maybe agents' commission is too expensive, those rumors or discussion gets us a little nervous.
This building is a crucible for rumors, a petri dish of rumors. Any questions?
Just a couple of questions, if I could. To follow on my good co-chair's statement, there are more rumors and things that supposedly I have said that I've never heard of come out of my mouth in this building that I've ever thought of, okay? So I hope you would take a deep breath and believe me when I say I don't think any of the things you just said have ever come out of my mouth, all right? But hopefully they haven't. As I envision this program, we're still talking about private insurance market being robust. We're talking about self-insured people. We're talking about employers who already have health insurance or employers who want to get health insurance to getting it. And especially for your group, we see a lot of individuals in very small businesses being able for the first time to afford health care, either for the FIAP program, through subsidized insurance premiums, through policies that might have a strong preventative care in it and catastrophic care in it, but maybe not a lot in between. There's lots of issues here. All those lead me back to believe that your book of business, so to speak, will be more necessary and not less. You'll have people coming to you primarily, I believe, from small businesses and individuals. Who's left the market right now? Big companies, for the most part. Who's out of the market? Small companies, individuals working two, three, four people in one office or one business. These are the ones that we've lost and we want to try and bring back in. They are going to need your expertise just as I use my broker in my business. I think that the future for you is such that you should put sunglasses on. It looks pretty bright. If this thing goes through the way we think it will. Okay?
Thus the easy trip up the freeway to continue to support this and our help where we can.
I think we are actually going to need you a great deal, because if things go well, we'll have more plans for people to choose from at varying levels, and we'll need people like you to help people through those.
Thank you.
AKA Loretta's letter, or Cynthia's letter.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, just as a suggestion to consider in further amendments, we have, I believe, have jumped to the conclusion with respect to a healthcare exchange, and I think that's maybe a worrisome issue. And maybe that's not the vehicle. Maybe the task of the committee is not to jump to how do you implement a healthcare exchange. It's to study the enrollment process so that we're matching product to consumers in the most efficient way and thorough way possible. So just as a thought, because I think Mr. Wood brings up a valid issue.
Thank you, Senator Morse.
I'm taking notes. Very good. Thank you both. Susan King.
Good evening, Senators.
Good evening.
How are you? My name is Susan King, Executive Director of the Oregon Nurses Association and emergency nurse by clinical practice. Also had the privilege of serving on the commission with our two senators. And for the record, I would like to say thank you for that opportunity. There was a lot of hard work, hard discussion, and hours spent for us to come to this point, and I appreciate having been a part of that. Like you, I had hoped to have a finished process and product at this point in the legislature or by the end of the legislature, and that's probably as much a function of my experience given the parade of patients that I see before me every day in my clinical practice. Probably also a function of age in that I'm feeling a greater sense of urgency for solving this problem as the days go by and the years go by. Before I make some specific comments about the current set of amendments to 329, I'd just like to say that my organization, both at the state level and the national level, supports a single system, and we hope that that is the ultimate end that we all reach at some point. And I think, obviously, we have many ways to get there, but that is an ultimate goal for us, and certainly based on the principles that are described in this bill. Some specific comments that I'd like to make on these Dash 4 amendments are on page 13. The first comment I'd like to make is that I'm one of those healthcare providers that you don't want on the board. So I think I can live with that, but I just couldn't resist making a comment about it. I was nodding my head when you said you're getting criticism for it, so I did want you to feel that. On page 13...
Should I warn her name did come up?
And I...
You were that close.
Senator, I won't ask in what context, at least not in public. At the top of the page on line 3, item E, and I think you received a letter from the Pulse Task Force, I would suggest that you consider adding a registry that would include either advance directives or the Pulse document or both. For those of you who don't know, the Pulse document, which is spelled P-O-L-S-T, and is inappropriately titled the Physician's Order for Life-Saving Treatment, because nurse practitioners also sign them. But the Pulse document is a very effective, simple document that reflects patients' wishes, but they are expressed in terms of a physician or nurse practitioner's order. And the task force has sent a letter to the committee. If it didn't make it to you, I'll be happy to get another copy of it. But I would suggest that the registry would include either or both of these documents, since they have a distinct function, one from the other. I did have a patient a couple of years ago, and a very elderly man, his wife was admitted near death, and when I tried to open the conversation about whether or not he was prepared for what was coming in a few minutes or hours, he asked me if I had access to a computer. And I said, well, of course I do. And so this very elderly man bent over, walking with a cane, took me to a computer and called up his own website that had his own advance directives and Pulse documents on them. So it's a very effective tool, and I think importing it into this bill would be very helpful.
Aside from my comment on the trust board, the other thing that I'd like to say is what you have produced here and we have produced is a way to get to a final product and some timelines for achieving that product. I understand, based on comments earlier in this hearing, that you're going to take a look at some of those timelines, since I noted that in some cases there was only a period of about a month for subcommittees to do pretty significant work. And don't ask me to be on one of those subcommittees if you're going to keep those timelines. So I appreciate the fact that you'll go through it and look for reasonable timelines as you refine this bill.
Yeah, she's on all four, isn't she?
Susan King, page 26, line 18.
She shall be in all four subcommittees?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Right. It's on the record. I would like to remind you it's there on the record. What I really do like is that we're attempting in this bill to bring the discussions under one roof. It's been my experience and yours as well that as we have proceeded through the first Oregon Health Plan and through these discussions, we have multiple discussions going on at one time, duplicative work that's not necessarily coordinated, and so I do appreciate that. However, I think it's important to retain the significant expertise that exists in those existing structures and groups in the state and bring them under the oversight of this board. So that is, I think, a significant step that you've taken. So with that, again, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to work with you on this project, and I will also look forward to working with you as we complete our work, hopefully in the near future. Thanks.
Thank you. I thought we were kidding. Page 26, line 18.
She chairs two of them, doesn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Don't leave.
Any questions or comments?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Susan, you work a lot in an emergency room where you have to deal with situations, unfortunately, where people are near death or at risk of dying. And I want to go back to your comments about advanced directives. Obviously, I also use the Pulse form a great deal in the practice. And occasionally I have patients bring in advanced directives that are about 10 pages long and somewhat difficult at times to understand. Even after they've marked it and I read through with them, I sometimes think some parts of it are conflicting. And I've seen two or three different types. The Pulse form is especially nice, and it's simple, straightforward, and as a physician, at least in my practice, is very clear. I understand perfectly what the patient wants and doesn't want. What has been your experience as a nurse in an emergency room facing the same issues, and would you support language that took out the advanced directives and simply substitute the Pulse form?
Senator Bates and members of the committee, your experience is my experience. There are three scenarios that we face, and I'm sure you do as well in your practice. First of all, there is no documentation. So a patient comes in, and we have to make decisions about care, and there is no document. So that's probably the most common that I see in my practice. The second is the advanced directives come. They're multiple pages written in legalese, and they're very hard to decipher or to wade through when you have a patient in front of you that's in a crisis and you have to make a decision what to do. You have family members that are upset, and even if there's been a decision made, trying to review that decision with them in that kind of a environment is very, very difficult. The third is where they come in with a Pulse. For many of you know, it's a hot pink document, so it's supposed to be easily identifiable by healthcare providers. Usually what happens is when they get transferred from another healthcare setting, it gets copied onto white paper, but nonetheless, it often comes with them. It's a very simple document. All the information that we really need to know is on the front of it, in terms of what they want, in terms of resuscitation, hydration, food, et cetera, antibiotics. So I would certainly support substituting the Pulse, but didn't want to preclude a discussion if there are those who really want the advanced directives in this registry. I think the Pulse is a much more useful document, and I would support that.
Well, Mr. Chair, the registry needs to be something we can look into and use quickly and easily, because that's the kind of situation we're talking about. When we have lots of time,
right,
a longer form would be perfectly acceptable, I think, for most of us. just for the sake of those here and for the edification, and my memory of the Pulse Forum is it was actually put together by a group of nurses in the state, and it's spread across the state. We have one of the highest penetrations in our communities of any state in the union, mm-hmm. and then other states have now looked to this forum, are starting to use it across the nation. It's one of those homegrown things in Oregon mm-hmm. that other states have looked at and said, this is what we need to use, and it's rapidly gaining acceptance across the nation. Is my information correct on that still?
Yes. Actually, it was started by, I think, early on by Dr. Patrick Dunn in the Legacy System, and some of the first individuals that worked on it were paramedics and EMTs, because the original use of the Pulse was to try to make clear orders for life-sustaining treatment as patients move primarily from nursing homes to hospital. So the first pioneers, if you will, were, yes, there were certainly nurses involved, and I was involved years and years ago with it, but it was largely initiated from the field. And secondarily, yes, a number of states have adopted our form and are using our form to try to coordinate and clarify care at the end of life. So it has been very effective, in my opinion.
Thank you.
How long has it been out, available, created?
It's been about 17, 18 years. It's gone through about six different forms, and we just made changes at the last meeting, but about 16 or 17 years.
Mm-hmm. And it's been pretty stable as mm-hmm. its present form for about 10 years, maybe mm-hmm. a small change, but sure. not much. You can read it and understand it. It's straightforward, right. And you clearly know what the patient wants quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been pretty effective.
Right. It's housed the administrative not control, but the administrative oversight is housed in the OHSU Center for Ethics, and you can go on that website and view the document and the all of the supporting documents that describe its use. It's very helpful. Thanks.
Susan, as always, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. Fred King.
Good evening. My name is Fred King. I'm owner of a small business called Hollander Consultants in Tualatin, Oregon. I have 50 employees. I'm also a member of the Tualatin Chamber of Commerce, a member of the NFIB and on their board, and also a member of the Governor's Small Business Council. I'm not speaking in behalf of any of those people. I'm speaking totally from my viewpoint. Having said that, I just want to go over a few things. You guys got a hell of a job to do. I was listening to all this, and I've been reading about it, and I tell you, it's a tough job. And one of the things that I wanted to go over, here's some of the points. I think if you start using the word mandate, however you want to play it, I think you're going to have troubles with small business. That's my personal opinion. I think the making an attractive, what would be the word, making it attractive so businesses want to get involved in it is going to be a key. It's a marketing issue almost in regards to it. If you make it attractive enough, people want to join, people want to do it. If you make it affordable, and that's going to be, you know, how do you do that without mandate? You know, that's what I said. It's better you than me right now. I'm trying to figure it out. It's a tough one, but that's one part. I think the funding on that, $200 per person, I think is a good number. I think also is that you've got to have the funding on it against the CPI somehow, as far as the cost, whether it's CPI or some inflationary activity, possibly a tax credit. The other one is small business owners, I believe, should be on the board.
Did somebody else say that? I don't think we've heard that before.
I think your criteria, the expertise, knowledge, experience, the areas of consumer advocacy, those things are great. I think a professor at the University of Oregon would also probably fit in those criteria. I think it's important that someone's had to make payroll, that they understand what that's all about and how to build a business. That's my personal opinion. I'm actually not against somebody from the insurance companies being on the board. I think the more people who are part of it is good, but that's just that. I would like to see the board do a fiscal impact statement of some sort. I don't know how it impact the state.
What do you mean by fiscal impact?
Well, if you're depending on what the options are, if you're now into the realm of using the M word, mandating, how would that break down, and then how is that going to hit and affect the businesses, small businesses as well as large business? What's that impact going to do? I know, as an example, small businesses, very small businesses, have a very difficult time on just, you know, paying overhead. You know, you look at a business who's got, you know, 1 to 10 employees, it can be real tough. You get bigger and bigger, yes, then you've got a proportional and you're reining over. But, well, what is the impact on that, you know? I don't know if you can even get it or how that works. But I'm an advocate of the fiscal tax reform activity that I've heard about happening, and you know, because I think we've got problems in there, but I won't go there right now. I think that's about the gist of it. I think the board needs to get up and running fast. I think it needs to happen. I know this is the choir speaking to the preacher. If it doesn't get going now, I don't know when it will get going. It's a lot to bite right now, a lot to bite off, but I think the situation at hand, it's just these double-digit inflationary activities going on to it, the people not being able to get health care coverage is really tough, really, really tough. But making something that is marketable, something that people can go to, I think is great. So that's it. Thank you very much. Short and sweet.
Fred, thank you.
Yes.
Senator Morse.
Thank you. If I may.
Yes.
Let's change places for just a moment.
Okay.
In our discussion here.
I don't know if I want to do that.
Because I'd like to pose a question, and this is a dilemma with respect to the mandates.
Yeah.
Real life example. Successful small business. The owner chose not to provide health insurance for his employees. An employee had a catastrophic health event, wound up in the hospital, could not pay the bills. This person came to the hospital administrator and said, gosh, can you help out? Okay, now that cost for that employee was shifted to those people that do pay.
Right.
And it's done every day of the year. What should we do with a business owner that by choice, it was a choice not to provide health insurance?
Right.
What should we do?
That's a very good question. And I think you should have somebody a lot smarter over here answering it for you. It's a conscience. It's really a conscience part in regards to getting the small business owners. I think it has to be marketed. I keep going back to that concept to small businesses that this is the right thing to do. It's an important thing to do. It's a conscionable thing to do. I use that word. And it's best for everybody. And I think a small business owner will see that they'll attract better people. People will stay with them. If other small businesses are doing it, they'll go to those people. And I think it becomes in a competitive market now that other small businesses are doing it. When you have two businesses, one is doing it and one's not. But you have that now with large corporations. A lot of people will stay away from small companies because they can go to a larger corporation and get those health benefits. And so they'll go in that direction. I think if it's offered that small businesses can do it and a person and a small business owner is doing it, people will come to them. I think it will be easier to attract people. People now will have to decide between small businesses versus maybe having to go to a larger business to do that, and they'll go, oh, okay, and it's just another a vehicle to attract more people, and I think it'll work. So that's my answer.
So you didn't help me.
You did a pretty good job answering it. Maybe you should be sitting up
here. You know, anytime you're going to tell somebody and mandate to somebody that they have to do something, it's going to be difficult. Period. You know, I don't care who you are in the United States. It's going to be difficult. Small business owners are entrepreneurial individuals who have gone out there and, you know, sweated and made it happen. They've gone and done it. And so there's a certain mentality with many of them that deals with keep your hands off me and don't tell me what to do. That's the truth of it. That's how they got where they got, because they were able to bust through that. At the same time, I believe they're intelligent enough to start seeing that this is a really good thing to do, and that this whole activity of getting everybody covered with health care is very, very important. You know, maybe you end up having to use a big hammer. I don't know. I hope not, but because I think you'll get a bit of a firestorm coming back. I may be wrong, but.
Yeah, well, thank you for your comments.
Okay.
See, I mean, the other side of the coin is, if you're this hypothetical small business owner, profitable small business owner that elects not to provide coverage, you know, you are then mandating those health care costs onto the rest of us.
Right.
That's a mandate as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Oh, that's a good point, and I think that's a I think that's a good point. I'm trying to think of you've got you know, my understanding is an example. People go in an emergency ward, and because they go to the emergency ward because they don't have health insurance, it drives the health insurance cost way up.
That's a big part of it.
Okay, person in the end of life type of situation because they decide to fight. And, you know, and as that Harvard professor once said, something that, you know, Americans seem to think that death is as an option. That, you know, they fight that all the way to the end, and those costs drive it up, you know. So, you know, they're mandating those people who are now taking that and you know, making the cost go higher are in essence making, you know, because I'm not planning on fighting it to the end. I'm not planning on doing, I don't go to emergency for every little thing that happens to me too. So, you know, there's this interesting kind scenario, really, a complex scenario in regards to it. And I don't know. I mean, you know, I understand your view. It's just, you'll know more if you use the M word and start, you know, start saying it, and then you'll have a lot more discussion in regards to it. You know, that's it. I mean, that's the simplicity of it right now.
That's our job.
That's right. You got the tough. That's why you make the big bucks up there, you know.
There you go. Thank you very much, Fred.
Okay. Thank you for your comments.
I might not do justice to these names. Steve Doty and Jason, I'm not even going to.
Bayrudy. Close enough.
Yeah, I can see that. Enter and sign in, please, gentlemen.
Co-Chair Westland and member of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Doty. I'm here with Jason Bayrudy. We are members representing the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters, which is a professional association for independent insurance agents throughout the state of Oregon. We specialize in the sale and service of both group and individual insurance plans. I'm a past president of the organization, and Jason is our current president. We're here today to offer support of the concept of covering the uninsured. The issue of the uninsured is much more than just sheer numbers and statistics for us. We work with the uninsured on a daily basis. They have names and faces. We work with them to try to help them acquire insurance and help them keep insurance. Insurance is something that isn't purchased one time. It's purchased every month. And it's a difficult thing for some people to do that. And insurance, as you know, is very expensive. There's a couple of things I want to talk about. First of all, and it's already been, I won't spend much time here because it's already been spoken about with Mr. Wood around the role of agents in this system. We also had some concerns that there was no language in even inferring that agents would be involved in the distribution of health insurance under this new system. And we feel that we play a viable role, a very, very valuable role, because we, as I said, we not only assist in the enrollment process, we assist in the claims issues and in explaining benefits to people. And we have a vested interest to make sure that people stay insured and that they're happy with the insurance coverage they have. So I think hopefully that as you develop this plan that there will be more than just an inference that agents will be involved, but there will be some language stating that that there's a valuable role for, and an important role for agents in this process. The other point I want to make has to do with the FEOP program. I was actually encouraged to come here and offer this testimony by Senator Morissette, although I see after he did that he promptly left town. So in spite of that, I'll forge forward. I'm not sure, it's not clear to us just how expansive FEOP will be and how large the role of FEOP will be under your proposal. And I'm sure you're both familiar with FEOP and how it works, so I won't bore you with a lot of the details, but just there are a couple of points I just want to make that makes FEOP very valuable from our perspective. One of the primary reason people don't buy insurance is because it just costs too much. And one of the biggest drivers of healthcare costs is the cost shift. We've already spoken about that a little bit, the cost of the uninsured. Some studies have estimated that cost reflects about 10% of private insurance premiums. But the bigger cost shift comes from government programs. The Oregon Health Plan and Medicare don't pay their fair share of the costs. Those costs get shifted to private insurance. Some studies have indicated that those costs amount up to almost 15% of private insurance premiums. So you add those two together, you're at 25%. The beauty of the FEOP program is it eliminates both of those cost shifts. We cover the uninsured, and we cover them with private insurance so that the providers are paid at prevailing rates, and so there's no more cost shift that comes from the government programs. FEOP does a wonderful job in providing people with private insurance, which also gives individuals access to more providers. People with private insurance can see more doctors, and there's some studies that indicate that they actually get better treatment in the doctor's office if they have private insurance. So we think that there's a very valuable and important role for FEOP. We're not sure how large that role will be under this proposal, but we would encourage you to make FEOP a very important part of this. It's already up and running. We don't have to create a new infrastructure. We don't have to develop new plans. All FEOP needs is money. And in fact, if it had an adequate amount of money now, we could take a serious bite out of the number of the uninsured that are right now, whether or not your proposal passes or not. And so we would encourage you to really give serious consideration to making sure that FEOP is a part of this and on an expanded role. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
And one of the great things about FEOP is we're getting back some of our federal dollars that were being under-reimbursed in the Medicaid and Medicare programs. So I agree with you.
And it's my understanding that we in the past have, the state has left federal dollars on the table, that were not matched because there was not enough money put into FEOP. I don't know if my information is incorrect. But
not just FEOP, it's Medicaid as well. I mean, we leave over $1 billion on the table because we don't have the first dollar, which gets back to the Fred's issue on fundamental systemic tax reform, which two of the four usual suspects are sitting at the dais on this one, too. Jason, go ahead, sir.
I was just here to look good for Steve.
You're doing an exemplary job.
Thank you.
I mean, we were going to talk to him about his sartorial splendor. Any questions? Thank you both, gentlemen. Lisa Trussell. Hi, Lisa. Where have you been?
Hiding. Mr. Co-Chair and member.
Loyal member.
Loyal member. I'm Lisa Trussell, and I'm with Associated Oregon Industries, and wanted to come in today and offer some comments on Senate Bill 329, which we've been following the evolution of, and wasn't sure if we should come in now or wait, and I thought, well, if I wait, it may be too late. So I may come back again after some revised versions, but based on the Dash 4 amendments, and I do appreciate the fact that you've had these discussions going for quite some time and that you are responding to the information. The cost of health insurance is one of the biggest concerns our members currently face, and the bulk of our members provide health insurance. We do have companies, though, that are, and I wrote down the word successful business because I think that's interpretation of what's successful. But, you know, we have companies that are husband and wife owned, just starting out. They employ people. They pay workers' comp. People they employ are typically family members. One of the family members will typically have a job outside of the company that has health insurance. But the company that's starting out, and especially in a cyclical business, sometimes they're getting money and the president's getting paid, and other months there's not money and the president's not getting paid. And so it's not, sometimes they're feeling like it's really going good and then it goes down. So I think, and I think that Mr. Doty hit upon the comment that it's not, I don't believe it's because businesses don't want to provide the benefit. The problem is the cost. And I note in the bill where you have a price target, which is a good target, but the concern is how do you control the cost so it hits the target. Another comment I would make is based on the exchange idea, and I think that Senator Morris touched on that, is right now there are a lot of policies out there. Finding a policy isn't a problem. You can find a policy, and they have various levels of coverage, different deductible amounts. The problem is finding a policy that you can afford and that provides some sort of adequate insurance. And to piggyback on Mr. Doty's comments, AOI has always been a big supporter of the FIAT program. We feel that's a good way to lower the cost of group insurance because a lot of times you're reaching dependents who are typically children who, if you can get them into your group program, they'll help lower the cost because they're typically a healthy population. And going through the bill, and I've already commented on the goals under Section 4 where you're looking at affordable health care delivered at the lowest cost, and I assume that would also be sustainable. But we are concerned at how you get to the lowest cost and get the quality. The other question we have is on sub-forum page 7 where you're promoting a primary care medical home, and I'm assuming that's similar to a primary care doctor or something, somebody primarily responsible for your medical needs. And my concern is do we currently have enough providers to fill that?
Lisa, that's an exceptionally good point. We see that as the portal where you would enter the system as opposed to going first to a subspecialist, a much higher cost subspecialist. But you raise a much larger issue with regard to workforce. And no, we don't have enough, you know, primary care docs. We don't have enough, you know, nurse practitioners. We don't have enough in some of the subspecialties. We don't have enough. So that's a real issue, not just for this state, but
okay. Let's see. Oh, on the exchange, and the concerns have already been raised. The delivery system that we have in Oregon, I think, is a fairly good one. And along with the agents, there's associations like ours and most of the trade associations where the employers are used to calling them to see. And like with AOI's program, we use agents. We don't sell direct. We have our agent is in the room, Mr. Beirutti, and he when he's bidding our own plan for our own employees, AOI's health choice appears on a spreadsheet with other carriers. And sometimes we're the cheapest, sometimes we're not. But there's other things that we add. And I don't see that we'd be eliminated, but again, it's unclear that the current distribution channels would still be available. And those are things that people are used to dealing with, and so that's something we'd like you to be aware of.
Yeah, I appreciate that comment because, and I took notes on what Senator Moore said, is the enrollment process as opposed to, I mean, these are suggested, I mean, mm-hmm. to, you know, to include but not limited to, and so we put in an insurance exchange because that's been bannered about by, you know, a lot of witnesses sitting in that same chair. But I think the larger issue is the enrollment process. I appreciate that.
Okay. And then on page 12, again, it talks about ensuring that all enrollees have a primary care medical home, and I just think that's a great goal. I just not sure how practical or doable it is. And then my comments on page 14 on the pre-existing condition were a little bit different. I understand what you're doing, and I understand why, and I understand that's going to be revised. My point would be that if there is pre-existing conditions, but you're going to offer a policy for someone else to buy to cover that, or the individual themselves, my thought would be that that rider, because I lack a better term, would probably be fairly significant in cost. And then how does that work with the 200 to 225? And just practically, how does that work, and how would people actually be able to afford it? If they're working for an employer, they could probably do it, but if they're doing it for themselves, it may be more difficult. Also on sub G on that page, I'm not sure if self-insurance it would still be an option. And
yeah, absolutely.
Okay. When I read that, it's like I have to have an insurance policy as opposed to self-insuring under that.
You know, and what's really amazing, again, we're not trying to be, the last thing we want to be is prescriptive or punitive, you know, to those good corporate citizens that offer insurance either through their own company self-insured plan or their existing commercial policies. But what's really amazing is you get into a lot of the larger self-insureds, and they're doing exactly what we need more of, and it's one of the things we're trying to get to in this bill. I mean, they not only pay 100% of things like smoking cessation and weight loss and physical checkups, they actually pay with a check on top of that. Go get a physical.
Mm-hmm.
Quit smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been holding their costs to, you know, 6-7%, while the rest of us are 12-14-16.
No, and that's true. And the other thing I would like to remind you, though, is that they can also formulate their own benefit package. And I'll use mental health parity as an example. I'm not sure how many self-insureds have full parity. My guess is if we surveyed the self-insureds, one of the things they've done with that mandate, they still offer a mental health benefit, but my bet would be that there's a cap, and it's probably very similar to the previous cap that Oregon had. So they have some flexibility to play with dollars here to invest them in the preventative type things that you've mentioned.
Well, I mean, we've got caps in our commercial policies today. I mean, it's what I've got. Anyway,
right.
We're not trying to undermine self-insurance.
No, oh, good. And let's see. I guess that's covers what I wanted to mention. The other thing was, of course, and I think someone else earlier asked, was about the cost of establishing the trust and that sort of thing. I understand that we're evaluating another bill that the House has that may be one of the funding vehicles to take a look at that. But a lot of good work and thoughts in here. These are just some things that different members have pointed out that they had questions about and concerns on how it would work practically speaking. One of the major concerns is going completely away from a model that we have today to the new model and not having a safety net, for lack of a better term, if for some reason there's a glitch with the new model. So And I'm sure those are things that you've heard previously. Thank you very much.
We appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Lisa, for coming. Mm-hmm. This issue of the pre-existing conditions just spawned the thought, and maybe it has already surfaced in our discussion, but from a business perspective, if you're recruiting someone to come to the state and you're offering, you know, a family coverage, and the spouse or a child, a dependent, has a pre-existing condition, that's a major impediment to recruiting.
Unless you would be willing to pay the extra premium. And depending on the skill, some would be willing to and some would not be willing to, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry I came in late kind of running around here. I think what we're talking about, we've talked about at length all last year and now of how to handle this pre-existing condition. People legitimately coming here with a family member or themselves with a pre-existing condition should not be a factor. In fact, it should be something you can offer an employee when you want to hire them to come to the state. We have a system here that's effective, that's less costly. You can come here with your pre-existing condition and be taken care of because you're coming here for a legitimate purpose, other than getting health care. But the tricky part is coming just for that reason. Okay? So
right.
we're trying to work that language out.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Lisa, thank you. And the one we've absolutely been looking for, Mike Grady.
Senator Westland, Senator Bate, gentlemen, my name is Mike Grady. I'm a family physician practicing in Silverton. I speak tonight on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, which I serve as president. The OAFP is a 1,300-member organization which is committed to the concept that all Oregonians deserve access to an affordable basic set of effective health care services delivered in a sustainable system. On behalf of Oregon's family physicians, let me repeat what I said before this committee when speaking as an individual a few weeks ago. We are grateful for the tremendous amount of work the committee has done to bring the issue of comprehensive health care reform for Oregonians to the forefront during this 2007 legislature. We believe that it is essential that the three core features of Senate Bill 329 and also actually Senate Bill 27 survive in some form during this session. They are that all Oregonians are covered, financial resources are pooled, and healthcare services are prioritized by their effectiveness in producing health, and as a society, we pay for what we can afford. We have concerns that Senate Bill 329, as amended, actually threatens the viability of the bill by being too specific in what we view as a more big picture enabling kind of legislation designed to get Oregonians to accept that there is a moral and financial urgency in changing our healthcare system and that this legislation is the necessary first step. The principles vital to this effort seem to be universality, sustainability, and fairness. We think simplicity is also vital in moving this process forward. We acknowledge, and my members daily live with the complexity of this healthcare system, but we're concerned that the bill, as it is amended, is overly complex for this stage of the process. We are worried that there are too many specifics that may weigh down the bill, inviting special interest concerns that will then obscure the overall goal to force a change in our system. In our view, it is enough that the bill create a transparent structure and process. We are confident that enough fair, community-minded Oregonians with the necessary areas of expertise and sufficiently representative of all stakeholders to fill this structure that they are available to fill this structure and conduct the public hearings and design a system that is fair and just and sustainable. We have some specific concerns. A 7-member Oregon Health Trust Board seems too small. The board will need experts in multiple areas as listed in the bill, and there will be a lot of work to do and relatively little time. A larger board would prevent burnout and failure. The subcommittee tasks and timelines seem too prescriptive at this point. Subcommittee names and general areas of responsibility may be all that is really necessary, including sentences about restructuring health care so that payments for services are fair is likely to get many different kinds of providers all excited about what their share of this will be, and the risk is that we lose the focus on the entire picture. And addressing the issue of medical liability at this point may raise similar anxiety in the legal community, causing a defensive stance and reflex opposition. Many of my members work on the fringes of our dysfunctional healthcare system. We staff the rural offices, the FQHCs, the safety net clinics, and attend to those left out of our current system. We desperately want your hard work and courage in this effort to move forward. We also believe that the problems of Medicare are the 800-pound gorilla in our healthcare living room, and we respectfully urge you to schedule hearings so that Senate Bill 27 can also move forward as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. You know, we go, your simplicity issue, boy, don't you wish we could just go, it's got to be fair, it's got to lower cost, it's got to improve quality and provide 100% access. If we could get away with that.
Is that all?
We'd be happy. So we're trying to balance, you know, direction and put tenor or flavor to the conversation. Mm-hmm. The timelines you see, we're working on ways to accelerate those, and I think we can do that by incorporating some of the existing commission functions, Oregon Health Policy, Health Services.
Yeah. I heard your remarks to begin with, yes.
And not only is that's that a vast reservoir of expertise, and the board, yeah. The 7-member board, is a temporary board, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. that board, based mm-hmm. on subcommittee work, will make recommendations mm-hmm. as to the mm-hmm. permanent board, the structure and number of mm-hmm. composition of permanent board. Mm-hmm. I think we've got the yin and the yang
yeah.
of it.
Well, yeah,
pretty good.
We're family physicians. We're concerned about stress and burning people out. And by the way, how are you guys doing? Are you holding up? It's a long way to June, and are you getting enough sleep and eating the right food and getting some exercise?
You know, maybe we should talk, because I've been hanging out with one particular family physician, and I'm not sure I've been getting, you know.
Hey, I've got 1,300 of them. So take your pick. Yeah.
We appreciate very okay. much you being right. here and what you do. Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. First, thanks for being here tonight. I know how busy you are, how much you got going on. I appreciate you coming over. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I appreciate you taking time to look through the dash fours with a critical eye. The things you brought up are the same exact issues we have struggled with for weeks. Mm-hmm. How deep do you go? How high do you go? Mm-hmm. What's the best level? Some areas were probably too deep and some areas were too superficial. Mm-hmm. We tried to put language all the way through it that says include but not limited to. We don't want to tie the hands of these very important subcommittees nor the board. And we've tried to do a balancing act there. We may not have done it as well as we should at times. Mm-hmm. But I've often thought it. I've read through the bill multiple times. This is awfully wordy. This is awfully complex. Are we going overboard here, or are we about right? And I go back and forth on that. We spent 8 hours a day going over many parts of word by word to get the dash fives ready to come out, and we've eliminated some pieces and put others in. We put in language, as Ben said, about Medicare now, because it is the 800-pound gorilla. We cannot afford to avoid. So that language is going to be in there about that, asking for congressional discussion.
Yeah.
All those things are kind of wrapped into this thing, and I'm not sure, but that your concerns aren't the same ones we have, and for good reason. I'm going to ask you to take a look at the dash fives, sixes, and sevens. You can't look at the sixes and sevens yet because they're not even there.
I can hardly wait.
Yeah, I bet you can. But the fives will be before you, hopefully within 3 to 4 days. And we've got to have this thing wrapped up in about a week and a half. And I expect we probably will. I think we have this thing done on time.
Again, thank you for your work.
So. Thank you.
Take a look at the Dash 5s, which hopefully public announcement will be out on Monday. And come back,
please.
Very
please.
Sincerely.
Thanks.
Anyone else wish to testify? Dr. Hayden. Come on up.
3 minutes, Mr. Chairman. I paid my dues by sitting there for 15 hours, so... I thought I would.
2 minutes, 59 seconds. 2 minutes, 58 seconds.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, loyal Senator member and esteemed administrator. For the record, my name is Cedric Hayden. I'm from Fall Creek. I represent Hayden Family Dentistry Group. My professional training is in anesthesiology, public health, and dentistry. I just want to read back some of the words that you have written and to join that chorus of accolades and what a great job you have done here. You say on page one, health is more than just the absence of physical and mental disease, and only one of the solutions is access to the medical system. I agree with that. You say on page three, healthcare policy should emphasize public health. I agree with that. Prevention is the only way that you're ever really going to solve the problem. People have to stay well. It's not enough to get them well once they're sick. They have to stay well, and prevention is really the only thing. On page four, you say that you should use the prioritized list, and you should. The prioritized list is an excellent tool, which has fallen into disarray, and you should go back to using the prioritized list and not cherry-pick items out of it, adding them in or pulling them out. On page six, coming back to prevention, you say that wellness is the thing to be emphasized and strengthened, and you couldn't be more correct. Wellness is certainly the key, wellness and prevention. On page 11, you say that the existing prepaid managed health care services should be continued, and you're right. This government actually stumbled into a good program when they contracted out the health care, the dental care, to managed care organizations, where they had local community organizations that had ties to the local population, private business, contractors doing the government. Instead of setting up massive government clinics all around the state, you moved it into the community, and it works extremely well. On page 12, you say strategies to utilize preventive services and engage in healthy behaviors. And in a stroke of an epiphany that you had, you say at the bottom of the page, empower them through financial incentives and disincentives. And, of course, nothing would get people exercising, breathing fresh air, getting out in the sunshine more, and getting a $10 check for doing it, or something like that. And some of those incentives are, if you don't smoke, you can buy cheaper life insurance. Correct? So there are financial incentives and presumably disincentives, although that's a little negative.
I think we're taking that out.
The disincentives? Yeah, leave the positive
incentives.
Stuff in.
Yeah.
The disincentives are coming out.
Incentives in there. Now, one concern I have is that I go all the way through here, and in the last month or two, there have been a couple of dramatic dental deaths. One young 12-year-old boy died from an abscessed tooth in on the East Coast from a cavernous sinus infection from an infected tooth. Couldn't get access to a dentist. Another death was a strangulation from a thing called Ludwig's angina, where they had an infected tooth. Their throat swelled till they couldn't breathe, and they strangled to death. So dental care is an integral part of health care. And you say on page 16 that you will consult with dentists, but it's only by assumption that I think that you include dental oral health care as part of one of the services to be included in this plan, and I wish that you would make that a little clearer. It would make me feel much more comfortable to know that you do plan to include my colleagues and myself in that. So please, in conclusion, include dental care. I have a modest suggestion for you in that you are not going to go a bridge too far. You say that you will not include hospitalization and medical care for Medicare beneficiaries, the senior citizens. You could include dental care. They have no dental care. You could include oral health care for that population at a fairly modest cost, something like $20 a month per person. It's not expensive, and I just give you that proposal, and I'm done. And I think that was 3 minutes.
Well, you could just keep talking all night the way you're going.
Thank
Any
you.
Questions for the good doctor, former esteemed colleague? Thank you, Cedric. Is somebody else... You want to testify, Andy?
Thank you, Chair Wesselin and Chair Bates. My name is Andy Miller. I'm Senior Policy Analyst for the Oregon Business Association, and I've been working with this issue for a long time. Excuse me. I want to thank you very much for what you've done here. It's fabulous. We're watching all the changes. We're glad that there's not too many specifics and too many occasions to make people nervous, but just enough to make people think. And we are working with lots of other advocates in the community to educate our members and the public about this need. So thank you. And I agree almost 100% with what Mike Rady said. Rady, is that his name? The physician. That was terrific. And I have one little technical note that I'll give to Rick. I think you've got a pulse. I've got an idea for your advance directive. So thank you very much and keep up the good work.
Andy, thank you so very much. Any final comments? Anything for the good of the order? Senator Morse is excused and we are adjourned. Thank you.